You're listening to the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Each week, you'll hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Americans for Truth Hour will help you to stay informed and engaged on the side of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with us as we work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. And now, here's Peter LaBarbera.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Americans for Truth Hour. Americans for Truth is a single-issue organization devoted to opposing the powerful homosexual, bisexual, transgender lobby. And our website is americansfortruth.org. And I'm going to make a confession today. This show is pre-taped. We did that because we had, by the time you hear this, it will already have occurred, the Truth Academy. And we will talk about that show in future episodes. But right now, this is a pre-taped interview with our special guest, Professor Linda Valdidson. Rena, are you there?
Thank you, Peter.
Well, I'm sorry I botched your name.
That's okay.
I'm sure I'll do it several times more before this interview's over. But we're talking to Rena because she was, by the time you hear this, a professor, an instructor at our Truth Academy. And the purpose of this ongoing Truth Academy, I hope to have this repeated in cities across the country, is to answer the homosexual activist movement. And Rena, you're in the area of the law and homosexuality and other issues. You don't just deal with homosexuality. How outgunned are we in the general debate, but in the legal field, is there something close to parity? I mean, are there a lot of pro-family resources on the side, say, in opposition to gay marriage as there are on the homosexual side, or are we outgunned?
Well, it's an interesting question because in one respect, I believe we are outgunned with respect to the strategy on both sides, and we can get into that in a minute. But as far as the number of organizations, the number of people fighting, I think we're definitely outspent, and we most likely are people-wise outnumbered as well. But I think a lot more of it has to do with the funds and the strategy that in some respects really hurts us at times.
Right. And Rena, I'm showing how much of a rookie I still am at this radio hosting gig, because I didn't even introduce you as who you are, which is
I know who I am.
You know who you are, and you're very good at telling who you are, but apparently I'm not. You are the professor, an associate professor at the Liberty University School of Law, and Professor Linda Valdidson. What classes do you teach there?
I teach a Foundations of Law course, which delves into the biblical foundations of law in America, and I also teach First Amendment seminar and some legal writing and family law.
Wow, and Linda Rena, I'm sorry, has a very impressive bio, which you can get at the Liberty University, liberty.edu, which is the Liberty University website. She has done work with Liberty Counsel, which is sort of the twin to Liberty University. That's the organization run by Matt Staver. And also, you work with my good friend Matt Barber, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, he's a little shy and timid in his viewpoints. I know. It must be hard to get an opinion out of him.
I haven't encountered that.
And Rena also launched the Day of Purity, which is a project is intended to encourage youth to make a commitment to remain sexually pure in mind and actions. And we discussed that in the last interview. And by the way, all of our interviews are available online at americansfortruth.org. americansfortruth.org. Just click the Americans for Truth Hour button on the right side. We'll have both interviews with Professor Linda Valdidson on the website. So go there for that. Now, you're also a mother, Rena, and you've got three children.
Yes, and they're homeschooled by my husband, which is an awesome opportunity.
Wow. And while you are fighting the bad guys in the courts.
Yeah, that's and in the classroom, teaching others to go out and do the same thing.
Now, tell us about that. I mean, you've got a wonderful institution there that's trying to correct the misapplication of the law that's accumulated over so many years. We talked about this in the last segment of our interview, but, you know, how do you see the day someday in America where our legal system would actually be more in line with the Word of God, in other words, God's law?
I absolutely think it's possible. And we, as I tell my students, we don't have to have the same number of attorneys as is out there that are being trained by the secular law schools. We just need to get you in prominent places and positions of influence, and you know, God can do the rest. And so I do see that day, and we've already seen some specific situations where somebody in the right place at the right time was able to turn us back on the right track in the legal arena.
Well, you're to be commended for what you do, and it sounds like we've only just met, and but I hear such good things about your work. And by the time our listeners hear this, you will have given the talk on entitled at the Truth Academy, entitled "The Legal Strategy to Stop Homosexual Marriage: Triumphs and Pitfalls." How long have you been working on the effort of the pro-family side to try to stop so-called same-sex marriage?
Since Mayor Newsom in 2004 began marrying same-sex couples in San Francisco, that was really when a lot of the litigation launched in this country, and we were there to file a lawsuit to try to stop him from doing that. So from that point for onwards, the last 6 years, I have had my hands in this legal battle one way or another.
And do you see the day, let's back up. Where do you see this battle going? Do you see that there'll be some more dominoes, some more marriage states that will fall to gay marriage and legalize it? Or do you think we're going to be able to stay, you know, pretty much where we are? How do you see this going if you were to be a strategist on this?
The way I see it, because the litigation hasn't been that successful for the homosexual activists who've challenged the marriage laws directly, and they've got a couple wins, obviously, Massachusetts, Vermont, you know, they've won here and there. Even in California, ultimately, the voters were able to win there, although we're waiting for a federal court decision. Right now, there aren't the direct attacks on the marriage laws taking place. They're going, as we mentioned in the last segment, the backdoor route, trying to redefine family, parentage, adoption, changing all of those laws and leaving marriage intact. The latest strategy, obviously, is to go to federal court and try to get the Defense of Marriage Act declared unconstitutional, and also to get state marriage laws declared unconstitutional under the federal constitution. And just like with Roe, it would declare unconstitutional the 30 amendments that have been passed by all the states and the 40-plus statutes that are across the United States declaring marriage to be a man and a woman.
Well, that's an interesting parallel with Roe v. Wade, because isn't it true that before Roe was passed, states were tightening. Some states were toughening up their anti-abortion laws.
That's exactly it. And then with one decision, split decision, all of that changed and all of it was declared unconstitutional and just took that issue away from the states. And it was by fiat declared to be a constitutional right in our Constitution.
Right. Now, before we go further on that, explain about this decision in Boston.
Yeah, we have a federal judge in Boston that has declared the definitional section of DOMA, and I'll explain that, unconstitutional. There are two parts of the Defense of Marriage Act. Not everyone's familiar with that. One of it gave states or recognized the state's authority to define marriage as they wanted to. So they wanted to define it as one man and one woman. It said you don't have to recognize or give any recognition to another state's decision to do something different. So that part has not been impacted right now. What has been impacted, at least in the First Circuit, you know, that Massachusetts area, is the federal statute of DOMA that says for purposes of interpreting all federal statutes, regulations like the tax code and all those things, marriage is one man and one woman. The court struck that down as unconstitutional.
Wow. Now, where do you see this headed? Now, is this who appeals this now or chooses not to appeal?
Well, that's what's interesting about this. You actually have, for example, the governor, the authorities in Massachusetts. There were two lawsuits brought that reached this decision. And so on the one hand, in one of the cases, you've got the state of Massachusetts on one side of the litigation who's seeking to declare it unconstitutional. And then our federal government is supposedly defending the marriage laws, which is actually a joke in this case. So the Obama administration is charged with defending the marriage laws that he's publicly stated he'd like to see repealed. And that was very clear in the briefs they filed. They disregarded all arguments in favor of procreation, that it's good for a child to have a mom and a dad. The only argument the Obama administration made to defend this law is Congress had the right to say that, well, marriage has always been one man and one woman. We'd like to keep it that way. It's the only argument
they advanced. So they took a minimalist defense, so-called.
Absolutely. Not just that. They specifically said all those things that Congress said about marriage and it's good for kids, we disclaim that. We do not advance those arguments.
Now, was this the brief filed by Solicitor General Kagan?
No, it was not. Okay. She didn't file the brief. It's under the Attorney General's office.
The Attorney General. Okay. You know, it just seems odd to me that this is how law works. You could just get a new president and all of a sudden a very popular law that was signed into law by a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, all of a sudden you're not defending it. So what happens? If this comes to the Supreme Court, is it likely to go to the Supreme Court, I guess I should say first?
I think it is likely that this one's going to work its way up to the Supreme Court. It's going to be hard when you have a federal statute being declared unconstitutional for it not to get there. But maybe not in this one. They may wait for another federal court to do it and see what they come up with. But I think it will move its way up. And what you're seeing in this case is what we've encountered in the states as well. You have states that are friendly to homosexual causes, and they're the same ones charged with defending the lawsuit saying marriage is unconstitutional. There's no real defense put forth in those cases, just like there was no real defense put forth in these cases, and citizens don't have the right to come in and stand up for the laws.
So what happens? I mean, if it goes ultimately to the Supreme Court, do they take that into account?
We haven't seen that taken into the account. It's just almost been ignored. The fact that, you know, we point these out in briefs in some of these cases that, you know, this attorney general has said X in public about the law, and the court doesn't seem to take much recognition of that.
Wow. Well, this is all depressing news, but there is good news. We're fighting back. We're talking to Professor Rena Lindewaldson, who is an associate professor at the Liberty University School of Law. She's also a leading pro-family activist who's defended a number of important cases. And you're listening to the Americans for Truth Hour. Our website is AmericansForTruth.org, AmericansForTruth.org. We'll be back in a minute. Back to the Americans for Truth Hour. We have a pre-taped interview with a woman I respect, Rena Lindewaldson, who's a professor at the Liberty University School of Law. She does wonderful work. By the time you hear this, she will have been a speaker at the Americans for Truth Academy. The Truth Academy is a project that Americans for Truth has launched, and we hope to have these all over the country. Rena, are you game to do more of these?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's so important.
We really are behind when it comes to battling the activists on the other side. And I think it's interesting that some of the nasty gay activists called our academy a hate academy. I suppose you would be one of the, quote, professors of hate. Rena, did you know that you're a hateful person?
I didn't know. I've heard it said, but I certainly don't think I am.
Well, to disagree with homosexuality in the mind of the left is to hate people. And it's Orwellian, and it's actually a very it's a cheap trick. And we hope that the media doesn't buy this trick. But Rena, you will have participated in the Truth Academy. We're talking – one of your talks was – the legal strategy to stop homosexual marriage, triumphs and pitfalls. And could you brief us on this case out in California that has gotten a lot of media attention? They're basically putting the will of the people on trial, correct? I mean, Prop 8, everybody knows, was passed by California voters, even though they were outgunned, outspent. They took the side of defending marriage between one man and one woman, and then it was taken to court. How did that all come about?
Sure. And just to back that up a little bit, it's really ironic what took place in California. You had the voters pass in 2000 a statute that says married is one man and one woman. When Mayor Newsom started marrying his same-sex couples, that law got challenged as well. It went up to the California Supreme Court. The California says, you know what, that's unconstitutional. The people came back just a few months later and said, well, now we're going to put it as an amendment to our Constitution, so the courts in this state can't say it's unconstitutional. Nevertheless, a lawsuit was started where the city of San Francisco was involved again, and they took it all the way up to the California Supreme Court, where the court actually said, well, I guess if they put it in the Constitution in California, we can't say it's unconstitutional. So the next step, with two prominent attorneys, one supposedly a conservative and one known liberal, went to federal court to declare the California amendment to be unconstitutional under the federal Constitution.
It's astonishing. They have to do it this way because they can't win in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, what is this? A decision could come any day on this case, right?
Absolutely. Trials been had. Closing arguments have been made. So we're waiting for an opinion.
And then the judge is a homosexual, correct?
There's certainly been rumors to that effect, yes.
Well, my attitude is any man who doesn't deny he's a homosexual, if he's called a homosexual, is probably a homosexual. But anyways, now, how explain the implications if this judge says, no, Prop 8 is unconstitutional. What can the citizens do then?
Well, at that point, the citizens, and I guess what's important to point out is the attorneys who brought this case, because it's Ted Olson and David Boies. You might remember those attorneys. One defended Gore and one defended Bush in the infamous Bush-Gore litigation. So with a prominent conservative attorney, Ted Olson, who's been before the United States Supreme Court and a number of times, actually used to be working for the federal government as Solicitor General, he's got a lot of weight. And so he's actually commented to the public that he thinks the Supreme Court would take his case, almost because he's involved in the case. So what this means is if the judge declares it unconstitutional, the California voters have nothing left to do. All that's left at that point is, one, it works its way up to the United States Supreme Court, and we get a decision from them. And then, two, the American citizens pass a federal constitutional amendment. That would be the only way to stop it at that point.
Now, I thought that the gay activists were sort of leery at this point of getting a gay marriage case before the Supreme Court because they didn't think they had a majority. Is that not the case?
That had certainly been the feeling before this case went forward. And at this point, they've sort of gotten on the bandwagon. They filed briefs in the case as well. And I think they're getting some of the same feeling that, Ted Olson on the case, maybe that it increases the chances. But their strategy had been to avoid federal court. In fact, a couple years earlier, there'd been a federal court action in California as well. And the homosexual activists were very vocal that the lawsuit had to be dismissed because the court was not ready, the United States Supreme Court, to declare the marriage laws unconstitutional. So I don't think at first they were happy about this, but they've certainly jumped on the bandwagon.
Right. Well, I'd like to state for the record that whether he's a conservative or not, Ted Olson is not smarter than God. And homosexual marriage, the whole concept is absurd. And I also would like to say that the notion of marriage equality being for homosexuals is also absurd, because even a toddler could understand why homosexual so-called marriage is not equal to the real thing, because homosexuals cannot produce children without the assistance of heterosexuality. Don't you just love that phrase, marriage equality, Rena?
Yeah, and when you said that, even a toddler would know. I can remember distinctly when my two oldest kids are now 13 and 10. When the point came, they realized the kind of litigation I was involved in and what I was doing, that people were claiming a right to marry, a man marry a man. Just the look of shock on their face and the what? They know. They know this isn't right, and it's not certainly not God's standard.
Right. And yet, seriously, though, in classrooms, that is one of the implications of the whole gay marriage idea and it being legalized, because as the saying goes, the law becomes a teacher. And teachers, for example, in Massachusetts have been more less reluctant to push their views, their pro-homosexual views, in the classroom, because they can simply point to the law and say, well, there's complete equality. Gays can get married, straights can get married. And so it becomes a vehicle to push homosexuality in schools.
I actually heard a teacher from Massachusetts on a PBS interview on the radio state that because now marriage was same-sex marriage, what really isn't marriage, is now legal, which is, I don't want to say that either, in Massachusetts, she has an obligation to train kids about these alternative lifestyles because that's the law.
Yes, yes. Now, Rena, let's turn to a serious issue in this Prop sure. 8 defense. I've been very concerned to see that the lawyers on our side, let's just call it that, the side against homosexual marriage, have seemed to criticize. Well, they have openly criticized pro-family activists, the more conservative, I would say the more principled pro-family activists like Randy Thomason. Is that because they're under pressure in our extremely politically correct legal environment to not appear anti-gay? So they have to say, hey, this battle over gay marriage is not about homosexuality at all?
I don't think it's that personally. Because we certainly advance the arguments and we, haven't yet been sanctioned, haven't yet been kicked out of court. I certainly can see someone saying, you know, well, I don't want to appear this way before the court, but legally, I don't think it makes a difference. If you're there defending the law, they know you oppose it. And so the idea that I'm going to, you know, compromise and say civil unions are okay, but marriage, we have to keep them in marriage, I don't think it's the legal culture forcing them to do it.
Okay. But nevertheless, there have been, and I've lost track of his name. One of the lead attorneys on the conservative side in that case in California, publicly in a letter, a direct mail letter, called Randy Thomason, who's a pro family activist in California. He called him a fringe extremist. Talk about the sort of the battle in this whole debate over gay marriage between the side that says, look, you know, we want to stop gay marriage, and the only way to do that is to make a concession on civil unions. We need to make this concession if we want to protect marriage because we've too much water is under the bridge.
Yeah, and essentially the argument is we have to compromise because God's standard is not winnable in this society. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yes.
I'm looking at my Bible here, and I'm holding it, and I know what God's standards is. But, you know, I think I'm going to compromise because I know better, and pragmatically, I don't think we have the votes. I don't think we can win in court. That's the argument. And I have two things to say to that. First of all, it's unprincipled and unbiblical. Like, God gives us a standard, and we are called to follow his standard, or you're going to shun away, and you're going to turn the other direction. You don't have a choice to compromise when it comes to God's standard. And so we're called to do that. And secondly, I got a favorite quote from Screwtape Letters. I reread those recently. And here's the quote. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. And that's what the compromise side is all about. Let's give them domestic partnerships a little bit. Let's give them civil unions a little bit. And we think we're going to hold on to what marriage is really about. We're not. We've just traveled all the way down the path, and there's nothing left to defend.
And then, ironically, on a practical level, aren't judges saying, when they see these situations, they're saying, well, you're giving all the rights and benefits of marriage, to quote the other side. You're just calling it something else, but you're giving them all to homosexuals. So why not just call it marriage anyway? Isn't that what happened in California?
That is exactly what happened in California. When you read the opinion, by the time Mayor Newsom did what he did and we got to court, all that was left was the name. They gave him every single benefit that was available under state law to same-sex couples. And all that was left was the name. And the court said, wait a minute. What argument do you have not to now just give the last thing that's left, which is the name? You've treated them like married couples in every other respect. It's a shell. It's empty. It's meaningless. You've got to give them that too now.
Yeah, and I've personally encountered pro-family activists who say that, look, protecting the name marriage is a victory, is really what it's all about. I mean, what would you say to that?
It's not a victory. It's a loss. And in fact, if you take a look at the Netherlands and somebody who was involved in the legislation out there, they've actually tracked, you know, the incrementalization. That's how they achieve success in the homosexual advocacy. They know what they're doing. It's their strategy. It's agenda. And you're playing right to what they want. And by giving these rights, and it's not a victory because God didn't say just protect the name marriage. He has something more in mind. And if you compromise, it's a loss.
Yes, and unfortunately, I think some of our people, even in the pro-family movement, just in the grassroots, feel like, well, maybe this is all that we can do. And sometimes when you're told by somebody in the legal profession, well, this is all that can be done, it's sort of intimidating because for people who aren't lawyers. We're talking to Professor Rena Lindevaldsen, who is an associate professor at the Liberty University School of Law. She was also a speaker at the Americans for Truth, Truth Academy. Our website is AmericansForTruth.org. That's AmericansForTruth.org. We'll be right back with Rena talking about religious rights versus gay rights. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you sick and tired of homosexuality and gay marriage being celebrated by the liberal media and popular culture? Do you worry about the radical gay agenda being pushed on young children in schools? Are you worried that the gay movement will destroy America's religious freedoms? And are you offended that Christians are called bigots and homophobes just because they agree with God that homosexual behavior is wrong? Americans for Truth About Homosexuality is a single-issue group devoted to exposing and fighting the gay agenda. They are not about hate, but love for God's truth. They are Christians, so instead of celebrating homosexuality, they lift up the many ex-gays who have left it behind and now lead godly lives through Christ. But Americans for Truth needs your help. The gay lobby has lots of money, power, and media support, but it lacks truth. Please help keep this show on the air and educate America about the dangerous goals of this anti-Christian movement. Make your tax-deductible gift online today at AmericansForTruth.com. That's AmericansForTruth.com.
Hello, everyone. You're in part two of our interview on the Americans for Truth Hour with Professor Rena Lindewaldson from the Liberty University School of Law. She's in the business of trying to teach students a more biblical approach to the law, getting back to what the history of America, how we were founded. We were a godly nation at one time, at least significantly more godly than we are today, I would say. Rena, would you agree with that?
Yes.
And I always wonder, you know, if sodomy laws were unconstitutional, how did they have all those sodomy laws in a nation with our Constitution?
And that's what people don't focus on. It's like, look at what was unconstitutional. I mean, what was not permitted when the founders drafted the Constitution. That should give you a clue about what our Constitution means.
Explain to the what's wrong. I'm giving you all these weighty questions that I've always wanted to ask smart people like you. What's wrong with the evolving Constitution idea?
Yeah, and I get that one a lot, obviously, because our students, you know, in the schools have been brainwashed to think that's the way it's supposed to be. But just take an example. For example,
what is it, Rena, before we go into it? What is the evolving Constitution?
Evolving Constitution is the idea that you have the written Constitution that was passed in, you know, 1787, and then from there it grows and changes so that you can actually interpret the words in the Constitution or find new meaning in the Constitution that clearly was not intended by the drafters. It's evolving and changing with the times, and you pretty much can disregard what's written in the Constitution.
Well, and I find it interesting. Okay, go ahead. Now go to your examples.
Sure, and because so many people think, well, that's what you have to do because it was written in 1787, and here we are in 2010. Obviously, times have changed, and my response to that is first that, yes, the Constitution admits that times are going to change, and there's a way to change your Constitution through the amendment process, not through a 5-4 majority decision in the United States Supreme Court. And secondly, this is a contract with our country, with our nation. Just like you wouldn't want your mortgage to be changed unilaterally by your lender or your lease for your home. You know, it's been a tough economy. I want to raise it $500 this month, and you just have to pay it because I think that's the right thing to do. We wouldn't put up with that kind of changes to contracts. And our Constitution is a contract, and it can only be amended by the people, not by the court.
Well, I'm glad you're teaching at Liberty, and I'm glad young students are getting a chance to learn a more solid jurisprudence. Tell me about this Prop 8 case. Back to that. You actually have written a sort of critique about the way our side, we're talking about the side defending marriage between a man and a woman, what marriage actually is, that our side conceded too much in trying to defend this case with this hotshot attorney, Ted Olson, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What was your critique about?
Well, and we tried to actually get involved in litigation to defend marriage because we saw pretty quickly that there were those involved in defending the laws that either, one, didn't support marriage at all, or secondly, were in the group that were willing to compromise on marriage and not defend it. And so we came to court, asked to get involved, and we said, look, we need to defend it, and here's why. The people allegedly defending it are making too many compromises. And for example, some of them were, there was a document that plaintiffs said, defendants, will you agree to these particular things so we don't actually have to litigate them, that way we can go on to other issues. And they're key issues in litigation. By conceding these points, it made the case for the plaintiffs that they were a protected class, essentially, and therefore leading most likely to the law being declared unconstitutional. So you had our side defending the law, allegedly, was willing to agree, for example, that, you know, the persecution suffered by gays and lesbians has been severe in this country, or that sexual orientation has no relationship whatsoever to how a person performs or contributes to society. The one that really shocked me was their willing sexual orientation is fundamental to a person's identity, and that it can be harmful to attempt to change your sexual orientation. I don't know how anybody who truly believes in God's design for sexuality and marriage can agree to anything that says it's harmful to attempt to change your sexual orientation. I know too many people who've changed. And so by conceding that, it gave away part of plaintiff's case to them.
Wow. Now, you tried to get in the case, and what happened?
well, we went there, and I had this document in front of me, and I said, you know, here's all the things that we say are not being defended appropriately, and therefore most likely going to lead to the law not being defended. And the court, we listened to it all, and in the end didn't allow us in the case, and said that that was a tactical decision on the part of the defendants to not make those arguments. So now, litigation tactics was sufficient to give away essentially plaintiff's case.
Now, to be fair to the other side, to our guys, it's very difficult to argue in California because California has pretty much legalized every aspect up until the word gay marriage. They've totally passed a comprehensive civil unions type legislation, right?
Absolutely.
And so, our side. And many people, as we talked about, feel like, well, it's the word that counts. How do you defend in a situation like that when the legislators themselves have passed civil unions?
Sure, they've passed these laws, but now you're being asked in the context of the federal constitutional challenge. And so does our United States Constitution protect sexual orientation as a special class? Is it going to have the result that the marriage laws are unconstitutional? When you're in that context, yes, you have what the legislature has said in California, but you've also got what the people said, and that's what's being challenged, the amendment. And the people spoke and said, we want to protect marriage. So they've got a duty, if they're going to defend that law, to defend the amendment, not what the legislature did with any statutes that it passed.
Right. So it's all about the amendment and the people's right to vote on this issue. And how many states have passed anti-gay marriage laws?
We've got 30 amendments, and we have about 40 total state statutes.
Right. And yet the homosexuals activists are willing to basically have it all struck down by the Supreme Court. And how do you see the Supreme Court shaping up yourself? How do you see the makeup on the homosexual issue?
Well, it depends on Justice Kennedy in all respect on
that's,
how
that's
he's
scary.
Going to rule.
You mean our whole future is hanging on Justice Kennedy?
I think at this point, yes.
Now, didn't Justice Kennedy compromise? And I wanted to talk to you about this, and this relates to suspect class. Suspect class, explain, this is still confusing to me. Explain what that is. This is the big kahuna, right? This is what they, once they get this, they fall under the same rubric, same category as racial minorities.
That's exactly it. There's only a handful, and it's all about what does a state have to prove to defend their law. So if something's a suspect class, the state has the burden to show compelling reasons for the law that it passed. And so if sexual orientation is a protected class like race and national origin, which are two of the protected classes, then it's going to be the government's burden to prove they have a compelling reason to say that marriage should be one man and one woman. Most laws are struck down if the standard is compelling justification. If it's not a protected class, then the government almost doesn't have to show anything. The other side has to come in and say, there's no possible reason why you would limit marriage to one man and one woman. That's a much harder burden.
How do we get to the point where suspect class, these terms that are now part of the whole lexicon of the field that you're in, how did that come about? How long has this concept of suspect class been in existence?
A lot of it came after the 1964 civil rights legislation and then cases after that. So again, all of this terminology, you're not going to find it if you read your Constitution. It's all been judicially created, and definitely in the last 60 years, we have seen a lot of litigation in this area.
Now, can you tell me how close are the gay activists to getting that suspect class? What's the closest they've come in the federal court?
In the federal court, they haven't come at all.
Okay, are they close to winning that designation? I mean, or that would that be the landmark decision by the Supreme Court?
If the Supreme Court rendered it, that would ultimately change all across the board. I think the decision in California possibly could be our first decision declaring them a suspect class if we were to lose that case.
And then would that be the major point of review by the U.S. Supreme Court, whether they indeed deserve suspect class? And then I should follow by saying, why don't they deserve suspect class?
Sure. I mean, that would be point number one. And in all of this litigation over the last few years on marriage, that's the battle. I got to convince the court that the standard is rational basis, the limited review, and the other side's trying to say, no, it's strict scrutiny, the tough review. And if the court applies the right test, we usually win in defending marriage. And so that is going to be the battle when it goes up through the appellate courts. What's the standard? Because that dictates the result. And as far as why it shouldn't be, it's really quite simple. When you look at what determines suspect class in this country, race, national origin, and age. That's the end of the categories.
In other words, things that can't change.
You can't change. You can't change the fact you're getting older. You can't change where you came from. And you can't change your race, obviously. And religion, even though it's protected by the First Amendment, it rarely gets that kind of scrutiny that race gets. And then as far as gender, being female versus male, that doesn't even get strict scrutiny in this country.
Wow. So to reiterate, suspect class status is crucial because, God forbid, if suspect class was granted and it was and the Supreme Court validated it at the federal level, would that mean essentially that homosexuals would be treated just like racial victims of discrimination? I mean, what would be the effect of that, and how would you see that playing out in, for example, what we talked about last interview, the First Amendment battles religious freedom? What happens if they get this coveted status?
If they get that, it'd be just like race. So all of the statutes that are out there protecting individuals based on race, they would get strict scrutiny, and they're uniformly struck down. Any law based on race, it's presumed unconstitutional. So every law touching on any alleged discrimination based on sexual orientation would be presumed to be unconstitutional, and the government would have to show compelling reasons for it. Very hard to do.
Does that include citizen action? Citizen-initiated drives, like, for example, ballot measures?
Absolutely. We've already seen that, actually.
Yes.
The United States Supreme Court in Romer didn't even use strict scrutiny. They decided under even the rational level, the lower level, that an amendment by Colorado that essentially said no county, city in our state can protect people based on sexual orientation, the United States Supreme Court said that that was based on animus, which is hate, and declared it unconstitutional.
Now let's back up. That was Romer versus Evans. When did that happen?
1996.
Okay, and that was the citizens trying to enact their own ballot measure, which would deny sort of special rights legislation giving special legal protections to homosexuals. Correct?
Yes, that's it.
We're talking to Professor Rena Linda Valtzen. She is the professor associate professor at Liberty University School of Law. We'll be talking to Rena one more segment right back after the break. Hello, everyone. We're in our final segment of our two-part interview with Professor Rena Linda Valtzen, who is a professor at the Liberty University School of Law. She's also active with the Liberty Council. Liberty's website is lc.org, www.lc.org. Our website here at Americans for Truth is americansfortruth.org. And by the time this interview airs, and especially when it's on the website at americansfortruth.org, Rena will have spoken. I'm sorry, I keep calling you that, Rena. Rena will have spoken at our AFTA Truth Academy. The Truth Academy is a project that has just been launched by Americans for Truth to try to educate Americans to answer and counter the misinformation of the other side, the gay activist movement. Now, Rena, you were talking about Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
To back up, that was a case where citizens got together. They said, we don't want these sexual orientation laws that were proliferating around in Denver and other cities in Colorado. So they passed a statewide measure, which would basically say that you cannot have civil rights based on homosexuality. I'm simplifying. And then they passed that. Lo and behold, they were outspent, outgunned, but they passed this measure. And then this was litigated. And what happened? The Supreme Court struck down their measure.
Sure. Let me just correct one thing, just the way you said civil rights, because, you know, we're not denying them of civil rights that are available to everybody. Colorado, what it said, said right here is you can't pass any ordinance that would give you a claim that you were some minority or entitled to some quota or special protected class.
Right. Okay.
Which is very different. And so that's what the people passed. It went up to the United States Supreme Court, and the court looking at the other side argued, you know, give us special class, suspect class. They wanted it already in Romer v. Evans. And the court said, you know, we don't even need to decide that because looking at this one under the lower level of scrutiny, you have no reason whatsoever, state, for having passed an amendment like this. And what they said, I'm quoting right here, is that the inference from this statute is that it seeks to disadvantage and impose based on animosity toward the class of people affected. So this is just hate, and so it's unconstitutional.
A fancy way of saying that people pass that because they hate homosexuals.
Yeah, which, by the way, first, obviously wasn't true, but second, that's not a constitutional standard. That's not part of our lexicon. So that was new with Romer. And now ever since Romer, that's what they throw out. You ask, why do they always throw out hate? This is where it stems from. This is in all the litigation. They passed that law because of hate. They passed that law because of hate. Therefore, Romer says it's unconstitutional.
Which they apply to the whole gay marriage debate.
It's
not about marriage, it's about
hate.
Now, you talked earlier about the suspect class. This is mm-hmm. This is the one they want. This is the status they want. What is the danger of this status? Would people in the inevitable battles between religious freedom and pro-homosexual laws and so-called gay rights, why is this suspect class status so important, and what effect would that have on our religious freedom to live out our moral opposition to homosexuality?
Sure. If they get suspect classification based on sexual orientation, that means any law that's passed that somehow disadvantages based on sexual orientation has to have a compelling reason. So ask yourself, if you pass a law and say you give an exemption, for example, to individuals who own an apartment complex and they don't want to rent to a homosexual couple or even an unmarried couple who's living together, they don't want to rent. Oh, wait a minute, you're discriminating against me based on my sexual orientation. Well, yeah, but it's our religious liberties, and that's protected in this country as well. Yeah, but the case law thus far doesn't protect religious liberties as much as it does something that's been given suspect classification, because religious liberties in this country as a result of Supreme Court decisions no longer is at the same level of suspect classification. So put the two on a scale, and the suspect classification based on sexual orientation is going to weigh more, is entitled to more weight, and you lose with your religious liberties and free speech.
I don't understand that. How can religious liberties be under anything? I thought it was our first right. It's the reason America was formed, to people fleeing religious persecution. How is it suddenly sublimated to something else?
The United States Supreme Court. That's what it comes down to. When I teach First Amendment seminar, the students look at this, and there are dozens of tests that the court has created, all under what is entitled free speech. So we don't have free speech. They said, well, in this situation, it's this test, it's this test, it's this test, and it's always a balancing.
For example, the bubble laws around abortion clinics.
Exactly.
You can only get within certain number of feet of an abortion mill. You do not have free speech to protest.
Right. And why? Because that woman has been given a right to kill her unborn child by the United States Supreme Court.
It's like a Rube Goldberg-esque monstrosity that's being created at the Supreme Court, and we're supposed to make sense of it. And how does this empower people if these decisions are being made? And what can be done except what you're doing, which is the long-term change, getting back to a more healthy standard for our legal system?
It's a long-term change in the legal system, but it's education, which is why I believe this Truth Academy is so important. We need to educate the citizens so that they're encouraged to be active in this area, so they know how to hold their legislators and judges account. Judges can be impeached. Legislatures can be taken out of office, but our people don't know what their rights are or know how this impacts them so that they take action.
Now, Rena, you talked about some of these cases, for example, the New Mexico case with mm-hmm. the Christian photographer. There is a new case out of, there's the Julia Ward case she just lost. She was a student, I think, at Eastern Michigan University. Can you explain that case briefly?
Honestly, I haven't looked at that one recently.
Well, that's one, I think I've got it, where she basically did not want to counsel.
Yes.
No, she refused because of her Christian beliefs.
Right, which is similar to the Georgia case that has just come out, and that's not surprising. The American Psychological Association and American Counseling Association have set standards, and essentially what they've done is said, well, we don't think, we think you're born gay, you can't change, even though there's no scientific evidence, we admit that. And since we don't officially teach people how to train with regard to how to change sexual orientation, you can't do that. It's not appropriate for licensed counselors. And so you see the ACA and the APA essentially moving to a position of saying it's harmful to believe that you can help someone change their sexual orientation.
Right. And I guess I wanted you to get to, mm-hmm. we've got 2.5 minutes left.
Okay.
With the battles that continue to come, people, Christians, it's essentially Christians versus gay activists right now, but it could be Muslims, it could be Hindus, it could be atheists who believe homosexuality is wrong. Do you see these sorts of cases proliferating, and is it your hope that they will drive the interest and inspire the action that will be necessary to preserve our religious freedom?
That's exactly what I hope. It's why when you hear about a case like this and it's put out in the media, we're trying to encourage people, just as you are, to realize how bad it's getting so that we can all get involved and take action to reverse course.
Yeah, and you know, I just don't understand why people would not have the right to oppose homosexuality any more so than they wouldn't have the right to oppose adultery or pornography addiction. We believe homosexuality is a sexual sin. It's that simple. We don't hate anybody. We just we disagree with that behavior, and that's what it's about.
This is an attempt by Satan, and he's being very successful, to destroy the very foundation of society and the relationship that God designed. If he can win here, you destroy the family, which is where we transmit values to the next generation. So that's why this battle is so important.
And right, and what do you say to the Christian who says, well, Rena, you know, you're a little bit over active in that one issue. I mean, why, there's lots of sins. Why are you focusing so much on this one?
Well, not one, because they brought it on. You know, they're attacking my God's standard for marriage, and I've been called to defend and you know shed light on what's going on. So that's where I've been called. But you know, this and life. If you don't get marriage and life right, you get everything else wrong, and it just demonstrates that you compromise on God's standard. So these two are those key issues for me that everyone should be willing to stand up for.
And the parallels are so interesting. You know, the so-called right to kill an unborn child, and now the so-called right for two men to marry, when that is an absurd notion. Two men cannot produce a family without relying on heterosexuality. Parting words, 20 seconds, Rena.
There's a quote by Martin Luther, which I love. It's like, the issue of the day, if you're a Christian and you don't stand up and speak for it, you failed in your duty. And that's a paraphrase, but I hold on to that. This is the issue of the day that they brought to us. We're called to the battle. We have to fight.
And I commend you for doing that, Rena. Thank you so much for being our guest. We've been talking to Professor Rena Lindewaldson. This is the Americans for Truth Hour. Listen next week. Take action. Go to their website at Liberty University School of Law and get active. Thank you.
This was the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Tune in Saturdays at 11 p.m. to hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Stay informed and engaged on the issues of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with them as they work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. The Americans for Truth Hour, Saturdays at 11 p.m. on AM 1160.